a country torn up by violence, and humanitarian groups left begging for help.
You feel like you're shouting into the wind. It's depressing as hell because nobody's interested. You're not being heard. That is how our colleagues in Sudan are feeling.
Today, while the world watches Gaza and Ukraine, the head of a leading aid group urges us to turn our eyes to another area of dire need.
The more we allow this to continue, the more you can basically say the new norm is to tear up international humanitarian law.
What the crisis in Sudan tells us about challenges to humanitarian aid around the globe. I'm Nyla Boodoo from Axios. This is One Big Thing. The UN calls it one of the worst humanitarian disasters in recent memory. Sadly, today, a host of international crises might come to mind when you hear that description. But the UN is talking there about Sudan, which this week marked 1 year of a brutal civil war that shattered the country's medical system.
There were lootings of hospitals. The one in Zelenje that I saw, they took the solar panels that were providing the electricity for the hospital, and they came in while there were operations going on, you know, a woman having a C-section. And the surgeon is pleading with the armed group, the RSF, please don't take the solar panels right now. I'm in the middle of something. Take it after I'm done. I'm almost done here. You know, she's on, ventilator and everything. And nope, they just took everything. They just gutted the hospital and the woman died.
Avril Benoit just returned from Sudan. She's the U.S. Executive Director for Doctors Without Borders, known internationally as Médecins Sans Frontières, where Sudan is a top priority. The war between the government-led Sudanese Armed Forces and the paramilitary RSF, Rapid Support Forces, has killed at least 14,000 people so far, although the death toll is probably much higher. More than 8 million people have been displaced, and
maybe 20 to 30% of the health structures in Sudan are still functioning.
For more than a year now, Doctors Without Borders has faced the dual obstacles of too little international aid for Sudan, what the organization has been calling a, quote, drop in the ocean, and blocked access to areas of need by the warring parties.
In Khartoum, for example, the hospitals are not allowed to receive the supplies they need to do surgery. And so what are you going to do? You don't have any anesthesia. You don't have the surgical supplies. You cannot get them. You can't get the permits to get the goods out of Port Sudan to the hospitals that need it, and where your teams are screaming for it. And they basically have to flop down their arms saying, we can't help people because we don't have anything to work with here. And we are constantly under fire.
Avril Benoit joined me this week to share her one big thing and why her message matters for aid beyond Sudan. Avril, welcome to One Big Thing.
Thanks for having me.
Can you start by explaining the current scope of the humanitarian crisis in Sudan? What's needed there most urgently right now?
Well, it's a war. It's a war that has displaced 8 million people, roughly, although nobody has an exact count. We expect that around 25 million people, or half the country's population, need humanitarian assistance. A lot of the people ended up fleeing to other parts of the country, for the most part. And then those who were in the Darfur region, for example, ended up fleeing across the border into eastern Chad. And I was there recently having a look at the refugee crisis there, and then going over into central Darfur to take a look at what happened in places like El Janina and Zelenje.
What did you see?
Whole neighborhoods burnt out. The remnants of the brick walls, and then with no roofs. You see bullet holes in every single building. There was a lot of shooting. There was a lot of looting. There was a lot of burning. We heard so many stories from those refugees that are in eastern Chad of rapes, torture, of people being taken, interrogated for weeks on end. And a lot of it did seem to be targeting one group, the Masalit, who identify as Black African. but many, many other villages, including Zelenje, it's a big town in central Darfur, they are also prevented from going out to market, to going to their lands to cultivate, from selling things, from moving around. There's a kind of a containment policy. And so as a consequence, you have people suffering immensely, not only from those episodes of violence, whether it's injuries or losing limbs, a lot of gunshot wounds, the sexual violence, but you also have malnutrition that is setting in a lot of places. Malnutrition is, in fact, I would say one of our top medical concerns right now. There's even this one camp in North Darfur called Zamzam, which was already a camp from 20 years ago when you used to hear of genocide in Darfur. And in Zamzam, which has only grown now up to 500,000 people, there have been no food distributions to speak of for the last year. And so you have hundreds of thousands of people, mostly mothers and children, which is often the case in refugee camps or camps for displaced people, internally displaced. You have pregnant women, lactating women who don't have the nutritional status to be able to sustain what is happening to them. Their kids are so malnourished that we were seeing a mortality rate of 2.5 per 10,000 people per day across the camp, which is huge. These are huge, huge numbers. And the World Food Program is extremely limited in terms of the amount they are able to bring through, all kinds of access barriers that we can talk about.
I did want to ask you about access. The question of aid worker access to war zones became more visible with the situation in Gaza. I think it seems much less visible to the world in Sudan. Can you talk about what access looks like given everything you've just described?
It's always been difficult because of restrictions on visas, humanitarian visas. But beyond that, you also have all kinds of denials or non-permissions, if you will, of travel visas, the internal permits to be able to go from place to place within the country. You have all kinds of barriers in terms of what border crossings are allowed to be used to bring in not only humanitarian workers, but supplies, you know, namely those World Food Program trucks full of food for people. It's like a bureaucracy that is set in, and they're trying to control the security of the zone, right? They don't want the trucks or the people to be smuggling in weapons. You have to cross a lot of checkpoints. The checkpoints are not always controlled by the government forces, the SAF. Sometimes it's other militias or criminal groups and what have you. So the risks are very high. There's no question about that. But even for those of us who are willing to do this work, willing to bring aid and specialists and people and reinforcements, we are often thwarted just through this bureaucratic process of you request the travel permit and maybe you just don't get an answer.
So, Avril, how is that supposed to work? I mean, it's obviously a country in a civil war, in disarray. MSF has a vast amount of experience dealing in these situations. Is there a standard operating procedure for access when it comes to NGOs?
No, I wish there was. I mean, I wish everybody just respected the Geneva Conventions and understood that in a war like this, people have a right to have access to humanitarian assistance, that civilians have a right to be able to receive medical aid, for example. And in most places, you can negotiate that access. They understand that an independent, impartial humanitarian group is just going to go where the needs are greatest. We're not taking sides about who wins the war. We're not aligning ourselves one way or another on this political outcome or that political outcome in any peace process. And so usually it is understood by those belligerent parties that we're not going to get in their way. We are there to just help people. And normally, you can negotiate this with all the belligerent parties. And in our case, at the moment, the RSF is saying, look, we are the authority now in most of Darfur. They control most of Darfur right now. And we welcome humanitarians. Please come and assist. And you can reach their areas directly from Eastern Chad, crossing the border, and they will say, yeah, you can set up here. Now, of course, is there a risk of looting? Do they have total discipline over their troops and their allied various hodgepodge of militias? No, let's not kid ourselves. It doesn't mean it's safe just because they say welcome. What you have is what appears to be a kind of more of a Mogadishu scenario, that time when it was complete chaos and criminality, when it's a free-for-all. And it also creates a kind of behavior within the hospitals and within the health system where even the health workers that do end up staying take what they can, sell what they can, and charge people who have already lost everything. And as a consequence of that, you end up with a lot of people who just can't get treated. There are also places where we can't reach. Ask me about Western Darfur. I don't know what's going on there. We have not been able to work there. No international organization has.
Information is also a problem here, as you've noted. What about when it comes to media access and communication in Sudan? Much of the foreign coverage has been banned. There's been comm blackouts. Journalists have been detained. How do you deal with that?
Horrible. And it's similar in Gaza, where international journalists are not allowed to report on the ground freely without, you know, these very limited IDF escorted quick tours. It's appalling. And it puts a lot more burden on us to bear witness. It puts a lot of pressure on our staff in Sudan to try to describe what's happening. But even then, I have to say, it's been depressing as hell because nobody's interested. It's been a year of us trying to raise awareness of this war and how awful it is and how many people it touches, you know, and we just don't see that the international community, which is aware, but we don't see the escalation of the humanitarian response. We don't see real pressure being brought to bear on the belligerents to facilitate the aid, to stop the nonsense with all these travel permits and, you know, these impediments, the visas. That's the heartbreaking part, is that you feel like you're shouting into the wind. You're not being heard, or at least that is how our colleagues in Sudan are feeling.
In a moment, more of my conversation with the U.S. head of Doctors Without Borders, Avril Benoit. Stick around. This is One Big Thing from Axios.
The Smart Brevity Studio at Axios helps advertisers communicate in Axios' signature Smart Brevity style. Our team of creative experts, trained just like our newsroom, work with brands to craft their stories in a way that will effectively earn our readers' attention. Reach smart, influential professionals across various industries such as technology, government, healthcare, and more with Axios. Get in touch at axios.com/advertise.
Welcome back to One Big Thing from Axios. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I've been bringing you my conversation with Avril Benoit, U.S. Executive Director for Doctors Without Borders, which has been trying to get the world to turn some of its attention to the death and destruction in Sudan on the one-year anniversary of that country's most recent civil war. Why do you think you haven't been heard?
It's the access issue. If you had correspondents on the ground, you might get a little more international attention. There's probably racism to it as well. And this is what they will say themselves. You know, we're poor people. Nobody cares about us. We don't have any economic value in the world. And that's also shattering to think that there's this hierarchy of human value. Countries like Chad, poor country, low income as can be, it is welcoming 560,000 refugees right now in an environment where even the UN system says that it is only funded to about 5 or 6% compared to what they need to be able to respond to a refugee crisis at that scale. And for the international NGOs, there seems to be just financial pressure all over the place. We're all spread very thin. We're all trying to work in these crisis zones from South Sudan to Democratic Republic of Congo, Central African Republic, the Sahel, not even to mention Gaza and Ukraine and the ones that are in the news, or Yemen, which is less often in the news.
Avril, you mentioned the Geneva Convention. I think a lot of people listening are probably very surprised to hear that hospitals are being targeted. And when you think of the scope of current international conflicts going on, do you feel like humanitarian organizations like Doctors Without Borders are allowed to operate safely? Or are you also part of the target of war?
Medical facilities, like all civilian infrastructures, but medical hospitals and medical facilities in particular, are supposed to be protected if they are functioning. And there's a very high criteria to justify any attack on a hospital. So just because you say, oh, well, there were weapons inside that hospital, or some armed people were working there, or they were using it as a launching pad, you have to prove that. You have to warn the facility that you're about to attack. You have to give them due warning. And I can assure you, in Gaza, despite all the false allegations that have been flying around to justify the attacks on hospitals, our experience as Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, is that the hospitals we've been working in and we have been supporting are hospitals treating sick people, treating the injured. They are not running amok with Hamas at all. We wouldn't work in a place like that. That would not be in our best interest or for the patients. You know, we wouldn't tolerate that. And that's why in Gaza, for example, you see so many people who are displaced, looking for shelter. They will crowd around a hospital, the grounds of the hospital, they'll try to get inside the hospital because they also understand that a hospital should be protected. And if only that were the case, because as we've sadly learned from the beginning, nowhere in Gaza is safe, not even hospitals. And over in Sudan, it's the same. You just hope that there's going to be respect. But the more we allow this to continue, the more you can basically say the new norm is to tear up international humanitarian law. Like if we allow that to happen in Ukraine, where it was denounced, where the U.S. always was denouncing Russia for attacking hospitals, we have not seen that for Gaza. And in the case of Sudan, it's almost like just this passive neglect.
I mean, is that what you want people to know, that this is now becoming a troubling pattern of the way that we are dealing with humanitarian crises?
One of the main points that the humanitarians working in Gaza were making after the horrific attack on World Central Kitchen, which killed 7 of their aid workers, 6 of them international, is that it's not an isolated incident. And it just caught the world's attention and Washington's attention because there were internationals. Okay, let's face it. There's a ton of work just to salvage the Geneva Conventions now, based on what we are seeing time and again in different places. After the Second World War, when we saw so many atrocities and we saw the effect of nuclear weapons, the world came together and really hashed this thing out, looking at the humanitarian principles of a civilian is a civilian, even a wounded combatant. And I would say that we're in a moment where we should preserve this, because these rules of war do allow for people to receive assistance who have nothing to do with the outcome. You know, think of the children in Sudan dying of malnutrition at horrific rates. What have they got to do with any of the fighting? Nothing, nothing. We have to really, as people of conscience, say we don't accept that this is the new norm.
What specific action do you want to see happen next year?
We need to remove the impediments, the barriers to being able to deliver aid. We need to be allowed access at the scale to bring it to the people who need it most, to the places that are highest in need. And then from there, you would hope that even for the refugees, for the ones that did end up in Chad or in South Sudan or other places, that there is real consideration of what they fled, that refugees should receive, according to refugee conventions, you know, a due process to be considered for their asylum claim so that they have a safe place to be and are not just sent back into harm's way because nobody wants to take them. So, I mean, on a policy level, you know, in terms of refugee or asylum seeking policy, we would just ask that the international norms be respected there as well.
What is your message to the U.S. government about this situation?
The U.S. government has, in classic fashion, stepped up as the biggest donor, doing its best even for Eastern Chad, right? You know, the U.S. is right there, but we want to make sure that we don't forget it. Let's remember also where the funds are going in terms of these conflicts. The amount of funding going toward the military work in Israel, you know, we're talking billions and billions and billions. The aid that is for a country like Sudan is a little drop compared to that. So we need to just recognize that we are making choices about how to engage in the world, and the humanitarian aid side of things needs to be increased. And we're just hoping that as the various budget bills go through, that the U.S. will use all its power to leverage other donors to also put Sudan front and center. I mean, we need a scale up, essentially. You know, in the UN system, the scale up just means that you really prioritize a place, that you decide, okay, we're sending in our most experienced people, surge funding, cut a few corners in terms of getting things done faster, so you're not in this heavy bureaucratic system. And that's essentially what we need.
Avril Benoit is the executive director of Doctors Without Borders in the U.S. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for this week's edition of One Big Thing. Please send us a voice memo with your feedback or story ideas. You can text me at 202-918-4893. The One Big Thing team includes supervising producer Alexandra Boti and sound engineer Jay Cowick, who also composed and produced our music, along with Alex Sugiyara. Sarah Kehlani Gu is the executive editor of Axios Live and New Platforms, and Asia Whitaker Moore is Axios' editor-in-chief. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, and we'll see you back here next Thursday.
The Smart Brevity Studio at Axios helps advertisers communicate in Axios' signature Smart Brevity style. Our team of creative experts, trained just like our newsroom, work with brands to craft their stories in a way that will effectively earn our readers' attention. Reach smart, influential professionals across various industries such as technology, government, healthcare, and more with Axios. Get in touch at axios.com/advertise.